It's immediate how we can all go from, oh my God, it's all over, to, did you see this meme?
Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us once again on the Delco Young Democast. It's great to talk to you again. My name is Mike DeEva. Joining me today, Gina Amoroso.
What's up?
How you doing?
I'm living. Living the dream in paradise in 3-degree weather. Cheers, mates.
Cheers. This is the drinking episode, apparently. Also joining us, Pasquale Cipollone.
I was just going to say, it's funny how this introduction is a bit different. What's changed? I hope they can hear the glug, 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 glug.
Yeah, here's hoping. Before we get too far into the episode, I do want to give a shout out to a couple of listeners, Kristen and Jason, in Ridley Park. Apparently, after hearing our discussion about Christmas cards on the last episode, they decided to send to my house through the mail Christmas card with what I assume is their dog being clutched by the Grinch.
We never asked.
We didn't find out.
What if it's dog? Like, what if it's not theirs? They're like, oh, we just got a dog.
Yeah, we rented this dog from the shelter.
Even better. Walking to the SPCA. I need to borrow this dog.
Yes.
Our first piece of fan mail. I'm so excited.
I'm kind of curious how they got my home address.
I'm like trying not to be creeped out by it, to be honest. Like, I'm just trying to be excited the fact that like someone listened and loved what we had to say and then sent us something.
Yes.
Beyond the fact that, like, how did they get your address? I'm trying not to think about it.
No, one more time. When I say every time you look at this, it gets different. There's a grate in the background, and it looks like it was filmed, like, on the street. Do you see that? Right near the feet. Look at the background. It's like a grate.
Oh, man. Wait, what?
That's what I'm saying. First off, the calf muscles are out of sight. But on whoever is the Grinch, so keep up the good work. You're getting swole. But... Like, look at it again.
That's so that it looks like that's so that if one of the dogs has an accident, they can just hose the room down.
No, but it's only in one part.
No, it's definitely
it's all the way
though.
Across
if
the
you,
bottom. Yeah,
if you look at it,
like leaves sticking out, right?
Was yeah, there's definitely
this was outside.
Leaves.
Oh
this
man,
this was definitely outside.
What is happening? This is this has layers like an onion.
You look at it, and then you look out
Kristen
your window, you're like, oh my
Jason,
god, that was my backyard.
If you are listening, which I hope you are, because I'm so impressed. You need to email us or tweet at us or put on our Facebook what the deal with the picture is.
Actually,
whose dog is it?
Hold on. No, hold on. Wait. Actually, don't.
No, I got to know. All right.
No, we don't.
I think I like the mystery better.
Really?
Because I'm Facebook friends with both of them. So
no, it'll just get posted and we want everyone else to try and solve the mystery.
Yes.
It'll be like one of those. It'll be like on the placemat at Denny's, like find 12 differences between these.
How is the mask made? You know, stuff like that. What is it?
I think you can buy a mask like that. I've definitely seen a ton of people dress
hope
as.
Not.
No, like you can buy it like in the store, like as a Halloween thing. Amazing. I mean, you can get anything.
I
off
can't
the internet
keep looking
now.
At that because basically. it just changes.
Constantly. I'm taking it away from you.
Hide that piece of art.
Yeah, that's what it is. Call it.
Could
what
we
it
like
is.
Get that blown up, like downloaded to like the Staples website and get a poster size made of it?
Almost definitely.
Oh my god! And
hang
then,
it up in the office. Hang
and
it up
then,
in the office.
Like we can like autograph it.
Well, our first fan mail. We
to
can
my,
also
to my biggest fan.
And then we could also sign our first threat. I'm waiting.
No, not
don't
that.
Worry, don't worry.
Not that. We got off the rails.
It'll be sent to me. It's fine.
Just cut and paste it out of magazines? What are you doing?
I'll autograph it.
Couple things we want to talk about. We're going to keep the focus super local today. All of the great Democratic candidates that we had elected in 2017 took their oaths of office over the past week. You know, there was all kinds of coverage in the Delco Times. Basically, the theme of it all was, oh my God, finally. And
is
I will
this real?
Say, yeah. I will say I was lucky enough to go to the swearing in for the local officials here in Upper Darby, which was amazing. Councilwoman Laura Wentz actually asked me up along with about 40 other people to be her sort of like support as she took the oath of office.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she's terrific.
It's a very and Laura Wentz thing.
Exactly.
And I
she
appreciate
needed,
it.
Yeah, she needed her village with
her. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, it's, and everybody there were people that volunteered for her campaign and mm-hmm. did all this, that, and the other people that have been supporting her. We actually held the ceremony while they made sure that Laura Wentz's mother was able to get up the stairs because the elevator broke down that evening. So yeah, they were kind enough to hold the the ceremony so that her mother could get into the room and make sure that she was there, which was pretty awesome. And then, you know, no, I'm not going to go into the bad stuff that happened after that because this is for celebration, damn it.
Yes.
Nothing bad happened.
Yeah.
We have people in office that we have not had an office in over 40 years or ever, depending on where you live in Delaware County.
Yeah. We were able to take a look at the, I personally wasn't able to attend the swearing in of the county officials. There was a video on Facebook. I think that Amanda Hammack was able to stream that Facebook Live. I forget whose page she did that through. Unfortunately, you'll forgive me.
It was Jen O'Mara's page, right?
Yeah, it was Jen O'Mara.
Brian Zydek's page also did it.
Yes. Brian Zydek did one of the most adorable things I've ever seen there. Mm. He actually had his kids hold the Bible when he took the oath of office. So at some point they weren't able to like keep holding it up. So he actually took a knee so that he could still have his hand on the Bible with his kids holding it. It was adorable.
This is going to be great. Have you seen Scott Albert's swearing in?
Yes.
He's swearing in on Jamie Santora's head, which looks like a beaver.
He was actually, since I was there, he was actually just swearing in on his wife's hand.
Oh, yeah.
But the angle of the photograph looks like he's swearing in on Jamie Santora's head.
In
it's
real
incredible.
Life.
Is Representative Santora, was he wearing a flag or something?
It was a scarf with a flag print motif on it.
He was also wearing this look of disgust.
The typical look of joy that every pro-life candidate has.
Or every Republican in the county right now.
Glad to bring it. Whenever you want it.
Well, one, it's awesome that people are recognizing the volunteers from this past year because, mm-hmm. I mean, in a county that's never held seats or has been 40 years since we've held county council register of wills or whatever, like it really did happen because of volunteers, whether they've been volunteers for 10 years or, you know, 10 months. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really great that people, because that's really how you win.
Absolutely.
Is a grassroots door to door.
Yeah.
Encouraging people, telling people like, hey, you can be a Democrat in this county and not be shamed.
Yeah, that's a thing.
And
now.
Get a job.
No, but like it really is genuinely different.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm super fortunate, and I'm only saying this because I was involved, like, maybe less than a year more than you all. You too. but, like, when you get into this, you know, you get into politics, and I, at the time, was 21, and people were like, oh, well, this is Delco. It's always been red. It's always going to be red. And then within 3-4 years of being active, I see that that's not the case anymore. Like, it genuinely feels like Delco's different, even though Delco's, you know.
Yeah, and I think a large part of that is the demographic shift. Mm-hmm. The county is getting mm-hmm. younger and it's getting browner. Mm-hmm. So as a direct
and
result,
gayer.
I mean,
queer. I mean, not just.
It's not just white people anymore.
Exactly.
Story.
Exactly. It's not. It's not just sort of racist electricians.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome to Delaware County, the highest percentage of racist electricians.
I mean, but like I remember growing up and people saying like I would never get hired because I was a Democrat mm-hmm. or a friend, her dad works for the county and he was like, oh, I can get you a job. You just have to switch your registration. And I was like, no, thank you. I'd rather be unemployed. Sorry.
Which, oh my God, it fascinates me that they're just willing. There have been people in the past and, you know, still are. Some, but fewer, that are willing to just say that out loud in mm-hmm. direct contradiction
yeah.
of every law.
Well, it's really also interesting because I'm hearing from people who are like, oh, you know, people like Republicans who have been, you know, working for the county for 40 years are very worried about this, you know, are they going to lose their jobs or not? And I was like, and the person who said it to me, I turned to them and I said, you know, I completely can empathize with that. And sympathize because like, that's how Democrats have been treated here for literally 40 years.
That's always what it is. You're scared of the people coming in power treating you like you've treated everybody else.
Right, exactly. And like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to throw a pity party for the party that's been in every office across the county for over 40 years that suddenly there's a couple of blue people and you're afraid that you're going to lose your job.
Who threw out the charter allowing us just one.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Like, Republicans, like when you're like, oh, but, you know, Republicans put the charter in the 80s that they didn't need a minority member on their county council. they have no response to that, but now suddenly, you know, five people get elected on a slate and they're worried. I'm like, you weren't too worried about Democrats for the last 40 years, sir.
It's funny when that shoe's on the other foot, isn't
right?
It? But
right.
It's like, and their concerns, if they are competent and were hired based on merit, why would they be worried that their jobs would be in jeopardy?
Right,
because
exactly.
They weren't.
Right, exactly. They weren't.
Yeah.
District judge seats were just given out as retirement gifts. Like, oh, thanks for being a janitor for the past 20 years. Why don't you go do traffic court?
Right.
Seriously.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, on a positive note,
it's fine.
Shout out to the County Slate, you know, Kevin Madden, Brian Zydek, Joanne Phillips, Mary Walk, Jerry Sanders, and every city council, you know, commissioner, school board across the county, because we flipped a lot of seats this year and
crushed it.
You know, Joel Kuhn ran the Delco slate, so shout out to him too. He was from Virginia. We flipped. I went to Virginia and he came to Delco.
It's that trade off, man. It's that
one,
it's that
out,
knowledge.
One in.
Exactly.
We never lose the population.
Never. One Democrat goes out, another slides right in.
Yeah, but all of the candidates, all of the volunteers, everybody did an amazing job. People that I was proud to support.
Yeah.
And that was really important.
Yeah.
So.
Shout out to our fellow Young Dem, Amanda Hammack.
Yeah.
Ran shit.
Yo.
I cannot emphasize that enough.
So we want to talk, we want to spend a bunch of time actually talking about the races that are coming up. Now that we're officially in 2018, there are going to be a ton of important things happening politically in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in 2018. So just to kind of familiarize any of our listeners who maybe don't know about some of these things with what's going on in the state. Gina, I know you had a bunch of notes as far as going down all the different races and stuff.
Also, just as the quick welcome, if you woke up in 2016, stay awake because get ready. It's about to get even realer than last year.
Yo, all that good work that y'all did in 2017, we're going to need just as much in 2018.
If not more.
Don't sit down. Keep going.
We got it. We got in one good shot, but we need to finish the knockout here.
Here comes the
Absolutely. So, yeah, Pennsylvania is one of those states that in 2018 will be on everybody's radar because so many seats for us are open from top to bottom. And that means from governor down to state house and other municipal races across the state that might not get as much attention because it's on an off year. So we're going to start from the top and kind of just talk about certain candidates, the race, the district, you know, our input and our reactions to some of these people. So a big reason that 2018 is going to be so important is because a lot of the electeds that we have come in 2018 will be here in 2020, meaning they'll be here for the census, which in Pennsylvania means that we will be here for redistricting of the state, which for literally everybody in Delaware County, they should care about that because I don't know if you've seen the 1st, the 6th, the 7th congressional districts or any state house district in Pennsylvania, but there's a reason that Delaware County has consistently gone blue in the last, you know, 5 years as a whole county, but then is constantly sending more Republicans than Democrats to Harrisburg.
Yeah. And to the local councils and things like that.
Right.
If they're divided, you know, they've even gerrymandered it at the township level in a lot of cases at the municipal level.
I was talking to some women who work for Emily's List, and they, I think one of them was like the Mid-Atlantic or like the East Coast regional coordinator. And she could not get over how in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania is such a big state, how much like local politics and local seats and what, you know, even at a local level, how certain townships, counties, districts are cut to favor the Republicans. She said it was like a state she's never seen before.
Yeah. It's amazing. Like I, you know, going back to Upper Darby yet again, I live in Upper Darby's 5th district, which basically is a big thin line that stretches all the way from, like, you know, basically 69th Street all the way across, like, through most of Drexel Hill over to, like, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. You're in the 164 here, right?
Shoot.
Is Margo your...
Margo, yeah.
So,
I don't remember the numbers. I'm sorry, guys.
It's okay. I am crazy and remember them. So like, it's also crazy because like when you just look at that map, like not like you look at like the township and then like wards and commissions and all that kind of stuff, and you take it even bigger and like literally like where the 163rd and 164th, like you can see where they cut out so that they could like in theory give up like the 164 to a Democrat, but then like 163, you know, is kind of, well, was red, is very much a trending purple now. Yeah. And you see that across the state. Mm-hmm. And mostly around the big cities, right? Like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, the districts look so funky. Mm-hmm. And then you go out to Perry County or like North Central Pennsylvania. Luzerne. And like, right, they look, right, but they look normal. Like townships look normal. Yeah. And lines all look normal because they're all Republican.
And they're, and the way it's set up, and we're going to do a full conversation about gerrymandering at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. But basically, they've drawn it up in the state of Pennsylvania and at a lot of the county and township levels as well to make sure that every Democrat who wins, wins by like 50 points, and every Republican that wins, wins by like 5.
Yeah, they'd rather like it be a purple district than be a blue district. So, yeah. I mean, I'll give it to them. They know when to win and then know what to do when they win. They make sure they're in office for the census and they make sure that they do what they do in the census.
Well, they may be in office for the census now, even again in 2020, but the Supreme Court now is what, majority Democratic? And they have like the final, they're like the final block on that. So,
I mean, the 7th technically, I think, is up by, like, their case in the courts in PA is up in January. Like, they have to have a decision made.
Yeah.
Because the district might get redrawn before we vote.
State, local and federal is all going through the PA Supreme Court, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, we could actually, I mean, I don't have think it'll happen. Fairer
districts.
I don't think it'll happen because, like, we can look at a map and be like, yeah, they cut out this huge chunk of, you know, Chester or Upper Darby to put in the first because it's not white people and it's mostly Democrats, right?
Like how the conservative side of media is part of the first district or whatever.
Right, exactly. But it's hard to go to a court and say, hey, like, they did this intentionally. Like, we can sit here and say, like, yeah, no kidding. But to actually go to court and put up that argument, I think, is way harder than people realize, even when you have Democratic majority. But enough about my rant.
We'll talk about a couple of offices that are not subject to gerrymandering in any way because the district is literally the entire state.
Yeah.
So
literally.
Yeah.
I don't know. You could argue that.
Well,
you could. But
gonna,
I think
you can argue with Misters Mason and
Scranton.
Dixon
should just be part of New York. I'm just saying.
Well, I mean, but also
that's a joke.
Like when you look at Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania has a really bad history, or not a bad history, has this reputation of being a blue state. Because it goes governor usually and it goes president usually. But when you actually break it down, like what it looks like on a state level, it's red. It's like a blue circle around Philadelphia, a blue circle around Pittsburgh, and then it's red. And I'm not talking like a purple red where it's like, oh, it's trending. It's like, no, like this is like we're flying the Confederate flag in the mid, like 5 miles from Harrisburg when we were part of the Union. Fun fact.
Yeah. People joke about Pennsylvania, but like,
it's real.
And there are wonderful people out there. But it's pretty dang red.
Yeah, it's super red. And so then when you get gerrymandered close to the city, you know.
Yeah, it's very strategic.
Yeah. Oh, they're not stupid. But let's start from the top, okay?
Yes.
So we have a governor's race this year, y'all. Tom Wolf is up for re-election. He's the incumbent. His popularity has been going up and down his entire time in office. He had a high popularity rate this past summer. I think it was something like in one poll, like 53% of Pennsylvanians thought he was doing a good job and would get reelected. And then he had another poll came out in like October or November, and it was something like 40 or 37% of Pennsylvanians thought that like they needed a change. And I think that kind of sums up Tom Wolf's entire time in office. He does really great things like stand up to Trump, but then maybe drags his feet about, you know, Mariner East 2.
Yeah, the pipelines, the extraction tax for fracking.
Reed.
Look, I mean, I'm just saying, you know, we talk about it all the time, right? Like putting blue in office and keeping blue good. And
And making Blue better.
Yeah, yeah. Making Blue better.
And he has done a lot of good things. Very recently, he just vetoed SB3, mm-hmm. the hideous, you know, anti-choice, anti-woman. I mean,
at the end of the day, I want Tom Wolf more than I want any other Republican that'll even step up to the plate.
Yeah, and with the room he's been given to do anything over the past few years, which is zero.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll talk about the State House and Senate later.
Yeah.
There, as of right now, of, what is it, January 6th, there is nobody primarying Governor Wolf. However, there is like a nice large slate on the Republican side, and we're going to talk a little bit about them. So the first one, and I think she's very interesting because I think she's going to get a lot of attention. So her name is Laura Ellsworth. She's an attorney. She's a moderate Republican who has previously donated to Obama and Hillary. And if I remember correctly, when she first announced, she talked about how she voted for Hillary. I could be 100% wrong, but I'd like distinctly have that memory of her.
I mean, that's good marketing, if nothing else.
Right. Because what she's going to do is tap into Democrats who are either A, moderate, or B, are not a fan of Wolf and his work, but also are not going to go the Scott Wagner route. And we'll get to Scott in a little bit.
Oh, boy. I want to go on record as saying that I don't believe a moderate Republican actually exists anymore. Like, that's Mike. That's personal.
I mean,
that's
not.
Moderate
I think,
Democrats definitely do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I also think, like, a moderate Republican is probably a Democrat, but they are holding on to the Republican Party of 15 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
His name is Joe Manchin.
Like, yes.
that's a moderate Republican.
Yes.
He's been a good soldier in the Senate this year. So,
Pasquale, your thoughts on her, or?
It depends. For her being from Pittsburgh, the weird thing about Pennsylvania is, and it might be every state, but it's this huge divide over elected officials having to balance out. Like when Wolf ran in Philly, it was this big thing about like, I shouldn't say in Philly, on the eastern side of the state, it was a big thing about, oh, some guy from the Midwest area, which Midwest to Pennsylvania is York and Harrisburg, which is an hour away from Philly. Mm-hmm. And it was like this whole, it basically that it separated. And a woman running for governor from Pittsburgh, I wonder if like there's going to be a way that they balance that out. And the Republican lieutenant governor will be from the east part of the state. So like I don't know. It's so stupid and weird, archaic, east side, west side of the same damn state fighting each
other. But
the state
is so big. Like, it is. I don't agree, but like.
Well, and I understand there's also this big cultural difference between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and I've gotten into many arguments over that. Philadelphia is apparently, to my new discovery, more so part of the Atlantic seaboard culture, and Pittsburgh is this Western culture.
Very Midwest.
Yeah.
So I completely understand that. And I guess to unite the state in a ticket, which will spiral us into the next conversation. So I'm going to digress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So another person running, his name is Paul Mango. He's a businessman. Just like if I had to sum him up, you know, real quickly, he believes in bathroom bills to protect people from transgender individuals, apparently.
You can't see how many finger quotes there just were, but you know, a bunch.
And defunding Planned Parenthood.
So, cool guy.
Cool. I think I'm 98% sure that this is the man who has a new ad out in which it's literally like a child's heartbeat, like in the background of him speaking.
That's insane.
I'm pretty sure it's him. It's either him or Wagner, but we're not at Wagner yet, you guys. See,
we're saving the best for last there.
Whenever I hear the like bathroom bills, it reminds me of that news article where like that woman in like Ohio brought a machine gun into a bathroom to protect children from trans people. And I'm like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? The kid who has no idea what the...
Ooh. Or we could talk about
the kid who has no idea what's going on is totally scared of our person versus the crazy lady with a machine gun saying you're safe now, you can pee, like, okay.
Or like how many people in like politicians have been arrested for inappropriate bathroom behavior like
this month,
right?
Like, oh, remember that big scandal with the Republicans tapping their foot under the bathroom stall in the men's bathroom? Hmm. Yes, God.
Oh, God. So, all I'll say with anytime I hear somebody named Mango, all I think of is that old Saturday Night Live sketch with Chris Kattan. Yeah.
When she was speaking, I was like, Mango.
Literally.
Did you see Mystery of Mango?
I mean, he's just like a millionaire who is just like, yeah, I can do this.
What a shock.
I know.
May I live my life with the confidence of a mediocre white man?
I mean, you are the one of us at the table. No,
well, oh well, I only have one check that makes me not a straight white man. But I think the white male millionaire can be applied to our own governor currently. So
fair. Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's fair.
It can be applied to a lot of politicians.
I was going
to
say,
but
So the next is Mike. I can never say his
Terzai.
Last name.
Terzai.
Mike Terzai, who is the Speaker of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. He represents the 28th District in Pennsylvania. In my notes, I have literally super homophobic, super misogynistic. And in 2017, he famously shut off Representative Leanne Kruger-Bernicke's mic off in the middle of a speech she was giving. And it was very similar to Elizabeth Warren's nevertheless, she persisted type of situation. So that's great. That's wonderful.
So in less words, Terzai is just overall a scumbag.
Yeah. I mean,
if you've ever wondered why the state doesn't have a budget or school funding or anything to do with money in Pennsylvania, Mike Terzai, in his role as the Speaker of the House, is the reason why.
Yeah. And then finally, the person we've been talking through throughout this.
Personal favorite.
Friend of the show.
loves us.
Loves us because, you know, we're super, super conservative.
They love us out the 28th.
So Scott Wagner, he's a state senator from the 28th district. And just to sum up Scott in one sentence, he's very famous. He was on The Daily Show. A lot of John Oliver, a lot of late night comedians, because he gave a very famous statement during session that climate change, or I think he used the term global warming, because to them there's a difference. Global warming was caused because there are too many humans on Earth now, and we radiate so much body heat that we are changing the environment and the climate and the ozone.
Okay. So I saw that on your notes before the show, and I literally did the math because I know that a human being gives off 800 BTUs per hour of heat because that's a thing I know because I'm a riot at fucking parties.
But, I love it.
So I actually did the math, and I worked out that the human race as a grand total generates about 2 trillion watts of energy every hour.
Mm-hmm.
Just in body heat. The planet radiates out into space just because of science. I'm not going to give a physics lesson on the show here. 85 quadrillion watts of power every hour into the vacuum of space.
That's 2
trillion
is the
tipping scale. 2 trillion is the tipping scale.
2 trillion of heat is way less than 85 quadrillion of cold.
But are you sure?
Well, I'm sure. I checked my math several times.
Well, but I also have a very, very good request because, you know, Scott Wagner's listening to this. If he believes that climate change is caused by too many humans on Earth, then why doesn't he help with contraceptives?
Oh, see, that's logic, though. Mm. Yeah. Logic, and, you know, you're using critical thinking skills there, Anna. Yeah.
Also, he has something to do with the trash company, which is very suiting.
Yeah, he does. He owns a trash company. Yes.
I don't know why they don't just put him in it. And take them out. If there's too many people on Earth with their body heat, Scott, maybe you should just go to Mars or something.
I mean, yes,
the moon. Mm-hmm. Stay somewhere warm. Go away.
Yeah,
he's down to Florida.
He's just got a very.
He just has look. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm gonna take the high road and not like insult people's physical appearance on this show because that's.
No, there's genuinely a Dr. Evil look. And if you can't distinguish it, I will for us.
So governor is really important. And I'm hoping that Democrats show up and show out because it's really important when we have the super minority in our state Senate and state House that when, you know, a terrible abortion bill or a terrible, you know, public education bill goes to the floor that gets vetoed on that desk. There's a reason that we are usually, you know, in the bottom 10 states when it comes to health insurance and health care and public education and it's because we literally don't have an opportunity to filibuster in this state. So yeah, that's my little Democrats don't fuck this up.
Yeah, and
keep showing up like you did in 2017. Yeah, it'll be fine, but keep doing it.
And if you do one thing in 2018, but you've been stressed out every time you heard a bill comes up, just show up on election day and do what has to be done to make sure that we don't have 365 days a year of stress wondering,
for real,
do my representatives kill me today or is that tomorrow?
Voting is not the only thing you can do, but it is, if you're only going to do one thing, make sure that it's vote.
All right. So we also have the Pennsylvania lieutenant governor who is up this year.
What exactly does a lieutenant governor do?
I'm so glad you asked, Mike, because we have a former intern of the lieutenant governor's office at this table.
Dude,
right,
he governs the lieutenants.
What a fascinating coincidence that I was completely unaware of.
This is called showmanship, guys.
The
lieutenant governor has a few things that he or perhaps even she this year, because we've already had one female lieutenant governor, that they do. They are the chair of the Board of Pardons, Local Government Advisory Commission, the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Council, and they are ultimately at the end president of the Senate. President of the Senate is similar to what the vice president does on a national level. Kind of provides order within the state Senate, can also break ties. The Board of Pardons is crucial in a state, especially this year with the rollout of medical marijuana. Hopefully it stays. The Board of Pardons deals with people trying to get a second chance in the state, and the current lieutenant governor actually created an even easier way to get through to the Board of Pardons. And it basically is just a review of your criminal history and if you have one, or any false charges you've had, and it kind of wipes them away to give you a second chance. The Pennsylvania Emergency Management Council, basically, like when there are disasters, the state has to eventually get funding from the federal government. So if we have a really bad snowstorm that we kind of exceed our taxpayer funding for it, we have to apply to the federal government for aid and stuff like that. So that is the role of the lieutenant governor, and also obviously all the like basically VP things of Pennsylvania, fill in if the governor can't, is the governor when the governor's out of Harrisburg, stuff like that.
Nice.
And you also get the central office in Harrisburg, which is unbelievable from the balcony.
Cool.
Yeah, so we won't go like crazy in depth, but there is a huge primary on the Democratic side coming up. Mike Sack is our current incumbent. 2017 was a rough year for Mike. In the spring, he was under investigation by the governor's office, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it was the Auditor General.
Auditor General
was, so, all right, here we go.
All right, here we go.
There were complaints filed by DGS, which is the Department of General Services, and that is who, the employees who work in the Capitol that do basically everything else kind of are through DGS. And there were complaints that the current lieutenant governor was verbally abusive, him and his wife. And there kind of was just this real big push immediately to like shut it all down. And there was like a brief investigation and security detail was taken away and everything. So, yeah. So that was basically the drama that unfolded. And he admitted that there was mental illness involved, and I think, in my personal biased opinion, was a very honest, and I mean, like, it was a great way to talk about it because he wasn't lying.
Yeah.
If you at least own it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that was pretty great. But obviously that's something that has not helped his popularity, and he is from Philadelphia. He was a senator. I think Senator Sabatina mm-hmm. replaced him, and I don't remember the district number, but it's the Northeast Philadelphia. Region.
Yeah. So we won't spend too much long with the lieutenant governor's office, just because I personally think that we should talk state level way more than we talk federal and statewide. So Mike Sack is the incumbent. He's running for re-election. Ariana Beringer, she's an Iraq war veteran and an IT project manager. She started the nonprofit American Nutritional Security. Kathy Cazone. She's a Chester County commissioner and a businesswoman. And probably the most famous person, I think, running
probably
for,
the most well-known, yeah.
The most well-known is John Fetterman, who ran for Senate in 2016. He's mayor out in Lancaster County.
Is that Lancaster
no.
County?
Yeah, no.
He's way Braddock is way west.
That's
it's
way west.
It's
I'm sorry.
It's an older steel mill town.
And then we also have, there is one Republican right now running for the lieutenant governor, and he seems to be unprimaried from all my research. His name is Jeff Bartos. He's a real estate developer, a big GOP fundraiser.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that.
He's officially running on a ticket with Scott Wagner,
yes.
Friend of the show.
Scott Wagner actually convinced him not to run for governor, but to run for lieutenant governor, because then they could run on a slate. So either one of two things is happening. Either Scott really thinks he'll win the Republican primary, or I don't really know. Like,
well, I mean, it's kind of like when, you know, when they were doing the Republican presidential primary and a bunch of people started introducing vice president candidates to kind of like give them a boost in the
yeah.
primary.
Ted Cruz yeah. and Carly Fiorina.
Yes.
Exactly.
And they fought
yes.
for hands and she fell off stage. well, but also two side notes real quick. The lieutenant governor and governor are two different elected positions, which means there is a wild, wild chance that we could have a Democratic governor and a Republican lieutenant governor. Don't think it's happened anytime recently.
I think that it did.
Maybe?
Yeah, I think Ed Rendell's second term, there was a Republican lieutenant governor. Don't quote me on that.
It's 2017. We all have yeah. stuff in front. It's fine. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And then also there's another Democrat running, Madeline Dean. She is a state rep in the 153rd district, which is Abington and Upper Dublin. She has been the state rep since 2012.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a crowded race.
It is. But to make you feel any better, we also have a senator up this year. Bob Casey.
In case you thought you could relax.
And so Bob Casey is our senator. He is up for re-election. He is getting primaried by two individuals, Brian Kelly and Ray Urich.
I don't know
who they are.
Either of those people are.
Me neither. I will say I think Bob, since Trump becoming president, has done a really, really good job of being mm-hmm. outspoken. And
yeah.
who was once a very vanilla Democrat is now super progressive.
There's a lot of people that when Toomey got elected, all of a sudden we remembered Bob Casey was our
right,
senator.
Yeah.
Right.
And now he's been
front
and center.
And there are seven individuals up for the Republican primary. So that will wow. be a hotly contested primary going on.
Yeah.
And in Delaware County, we have two United States House seats up. The smallest portion is the first district, which is currently held by Bob Brady. He has parts of Chester County, most of Philadelphia, but parts of not Chester County, Chester City. He's being primaried by three individuals. Nina Ahmed, she's our deputy mayor in Philadelphia, and she's a former president of NOW. She's amazing. She's a badass. Lindy Lee, she ran for Congress in 2016. And then Willie Singletary, he's a former traffic judge. He's a person of note because he was released from jail within like the last year for lying to the FBI. But further, he was fired in 2012 for showing pictures of his genitals to subordinates.
To be honest, nowadays, if anybody's qualified for a seat in Congress,
yeah, like,
you know, he might seal that deal.
I mean, yeah. And because of the way that the district is, as right now, there are no Republicans who are trying to run for that race.
Yeah,
so it looks like it could be very similar to like a Philadelphia mayoral race where the primary really, really counts because that's what's going to carry it.
Absolutely.
So it'll be interesting. Bob is being investigated right now, Bob Brady?
I believe it's some of his staffers are being investigated for paying someone to stay out of a primary race a couple years ago.
That's not what you want. Yeah. No. Like a lot of money.
No,
like,
I know. I know exactly who that is. After the show.
So
at me on Twitter.
The seat that has most of Delaware County in it is our 7th Congressional District, which is currently being held by Pat Meehan. He is the incumbent. He just like a brief on his almost his just like just his 2017 because he only was reelected in 2016. He voted yes on the ACA repeal and tax cuts for trust fund kids. He votes 90% of the time with Trump. So he'll have a very difficult time separating himself from the Trump agenda when really, he's running.
And he's really reflecting the 7th district here, isn't he?
Yeah. but we have a very crowded Democratic primary. We have Drew McGinty, Elizabeth Mara, who's a realtor. She is someone of note because she was a registered Republican until like the last...
2017,
apparently.
Yeah. Dan Muroff, he's a lawyer. He's the former head of Ceasefire PA and former head of the PA League of Conservation Voters. Molly Sheehan, she's a bioengineer. And it is up in the air if Jalen Leach will continue his campaign. He suspended it as of December 20th, I want to say.
He suspended it as of being a dirtbag.
I mean, but there is one person I wanted to change him on.
We, as always, have to say this because the Democratic Party is inclusive of differing opinions is what we'll leave it as. But these are our opinions.
Of course.
Not the views of Young Democrats or the Democratic Delaware County Party.
It just so happens that the three of us right now agree.
Yes. And have microphones.
Exactly.
Get your own microphone.
So it'll be a very crowded Democratic primary.
I'm so excited.
But all of these, I'm super excited.
No, I'm excited for literally what's right underneath.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say I'm really excited that we have a crowded primary, but...
I know a lot of people, especially in the party, don't necessarily like primaries, but I think that they're important and serve a purpose.
Yeah, for sure. So, for sure. And I think that this race, because it is really crowded, will really come down to their grassroots and how many doors they knocked and how they make themselves stand out from everybody else. Yeah. Because they do have a big, you know, the 7th district went Hillary, but it went like by 2%, but it went like 19 for me in. Which is like really crazy because the stat is, and I think I said this in the first episode, it's like 91-92% of people are straight ballot voters historically, like year in and year out, and very rarely are they crossing over. So the fact that he won by that much when Hillary won by that much is really telling. So whoever comes out of this primary will, A, need to raise a lot of money because they have a large district and several TV markets that they need to get on, but also they're really going to need to knock doors in a really, really big district in order to turn off the vote for sure.
Yeah, the 7th district is nuts.
Yeah, and so the last thing, because we're not talking too heavy on Republicans, but I think this is just like really hilarious. There's a man who is primarying Patrick Meehan. His name is Joe Billy. And it's really interesting. So I'm going to go into like, I'm just going to run over the 8 stances he has, 10 stances that he has on his page. But the big thing that he has on his page is that like Pat Meehan doesn't stand for any of these things. So I'm going to tell you what he stands for. And then I want you to just think about the 90% voting with the Trump agenda. So Joe Billy, his stances on his campaign website include supporting President Trump, building the wall, in Pennsylvania, by the way, protecting
get
gun
Maryland
rights,
out of here.
defund Planned Parenthood, promote job creation, protect religious freedoms, aka be prejudiced and bigoted against gay people, repeal Obamacare, build a strong military, promote energy independence, keep government limited, and place America first. And he's saying that Pat Meehan does not represent the 7th district, even though he votes with Trump 90% of the time. So I found that very interesting.
This guy.
He's a character. I really recommend looking at his page.
Literally no words.
Does it look like a GeoCities website from 1994?
I wouldn't say that old. It's definitely like early 2000s maybe. Oh, no. But it's a trip to say the least. I recommend everybody goes because... Well, one, I think you should always know who's running in your area, even if you can't vote for them, in case they do win.
When he says build a strong military, does he literally not know we have planes that shoot people from the fucking sky with no one flying it? What? How much stronger do you want?
I think
like laser guns?
I think he just wants to like we can be stupid, but every single person can be in the military with a gun.
It's whatever. I'm done.
You know, he's one of those people that doesn't think a State Department is important. We should give that money to the Pentagon. Apparently.
Yeah, exactly. He was a former Navy petty officer and a volunteer firefighter.
Well, that's nice of him.
It was. He did.
I know the parts of Delco he's going to pull.
Oh,
on the top of my head, I know exactly who's voting for Joe Billy.
Well, it's also interesting, and that goes back to like he's saying that like none of these things that Pat Meehan does, but like Pat Meehan has voted 90% of the time. Like he voted to repeal Obamacare and he is very pro-life and, you know, he, the tax cuts for trust fund kids, you know what I mean? So I'm just like,
I just can't wait until Pat Meehan like fakes pretending to be like a first responder. And there's like a picture of him in like a firefighter outfit.
Stolen Valor video of Pat Meehan.
He's in like a cop uniform. He's like, I was a cop for 2 weeks. Like, I'm really excited.
Oh Lord. So I think the race I'm going to spend the most time talking about is actually going to be our state Senate race here in Delaware County. There are two state Senate seats in this county, but one of them is the 8th, and it includes parts of, I think, Chester City and Philadelphia. So it usually goes Democrat, and I believe last time Senator Williams went completely unchallenged. And I can't really seem to find any information if he's getting primaried or if there's a Republican running in that area. Mm. But the 26th is huge. One, there's a current Republican in office, Thomas McGarrigle. He was elected 4 years ago. So the reason that the 26th Senate district in Pennsylvania is very noticeable is because it has been viewed as the most flippable seat for the 2018 state Senate elections. For a couple of reasons. Even though that Republicans out-register Democrats, we have a higher DPI in this race than across the state this year. So a DPI is a Democratic Performance Index, which basically lets you know like how well Democrats are performing in that area. So the fact that we out-register Democrats, or we out-register Republicans, they out-register us by almost 7%, we perform with over 53%, which shows because the district went for Hillary Clinton 55.58% in 2016. So this is a district that's really trending blue. I think it'll take a really strong candidate to do it, but I think it's completely doable in 2018, which I think is awesome. The last Democratic candidate got 47.9% of the vote in 2014. So kind of like I said, it definitely shows the trending because then Hillary won, you know, 55.58% 2016. We have two actually really great candidates in that race, Tanner Rouse and Tim Kearney. Tanner is a former homicide assistant district attorney in Philadelphia. And Tim Kearney is actually Mayor Tim Kearney. He's from Swarthmore. And the reason I think that it's important that we spend a lot of time talking about state Senate is because we only have 16 Democrats in the state Senate right now. So that means that we are the super minority, which means we cannot filibuster terrible laws on the floor. Yeah. And we'll get into why that's important when we talk about the state house. But when you don't get a chance to filibuster, it's when things just pass through your house, your Senate, and then end up on the governor or get vetoed by. When a governor vetoes, they veto the governor's veto.
Yeah, meaning they can override the governor veto, and there's literally nothing that the good guys can do to stop bad legislation.
Yeah, so it's an important year to really look at our local elections. Obviously what happens in DC is super important, but we've talked about it on here before, like what happens in Harrisburg has way more of an immediate effect.
Yeah.
Would you like me to talk about the house now?
No, do you have anything to say about that before I sum up?
Not really for this. You summed it all up. All
right.
My only thing was going to be another shout out to that Democrat that voted on SB3 in Western PA and be like, do we have any challengers yet?
I actually don't know.
I don't think he does.
No. So it's also, you know, as we're going down this list, because this is the last thing we're going to talk about, it might seem like it's not as important, but I cannot stress to you how important it is.
Oh, yeah.
To not just vote Democrat in your PA House race, but to also donate to your House race for a couple of reasons. Our big races, our top ticket races this year, our governors, our lieutenant governors, our Senate, our Congress, they'll be getting a lot of donations. But when you're talking like state Senate and state House, it still costs you well over $500,000 to run a good race and to hire good people to make sure your race is being run really well. So even if all you can donate is $100, $200, that will really mean a lot to people at the state House, sometimes more than a U.S. Senate seat race.
Even if you can only donate like 10 or 20 bucks, right. You know, every little bit is going
to
make a difference.
Or even better if you can donate like an hour or two of your time.
Yes.
Right, exactly. Yes. It's definitely those races because it's usually, well, one, PA House tends to be the like first big race of the people who are running. Like there might be a commissioner who's running, a school board member, but it's the first time that they're going to have to raise a lot of the time over $500,000. It's a huge stepping stone for a lot of people to go from a municipal race to a state race, or even people who have never run before, this usually tends to be their first race. And it's hard to raise $500,000 when you maybe are not a super politically connected.
A little tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, so kind of like what Pasquale was saying, like if you can't donate $20, $200, then like donate as much time as you can. Knocking on doors.
Calling
people.
Offering your talent.
Yeah.
You a good graphics designer? Like,
yeah, volunteer your services in any way that you can.
Absolutely.
You know how to make one of them websites.
So real fast, I'm going to go over the seats that are all up in Delaware County this year, because the PA House races are up every 2 years. So in the 163rd, we have a current incumbent Republican. His name is Jamie Santora. He will be going for re-election for a third time. Which one of you just did that? Was that you?
we'll talk about Jamie Santora at another point in the show.
In the 161, we have Representative Leanne Krueger-Bernecke. She's a Democrat. She did not win by a ton in 2016, and she was one of the few Democrats to come out of Delaware County. In the 160th, we have Stephen Barrar. He's a Republican. In the 159, we have Brian Kirkland, who is a Democrat. In the 168, we have Chris Quinn, who is a Republican. He's an incumbent, but he is a newbie. In the 185, we have Maria Donatucci. She's a Democrat. In the 199, we have Joanna McClinton. In the 162, we have Nick Micarelli. He is a Republican. In the 166, another Democrat that we need to protect is Greg Vitale. In the 164, we have Representative Margo Davison, also a Democrat. And finally, in the 165, we have Alex Charlton, who is a Republican, who is going through his first term. It's a lot. I mean, you look at all these people who are coming just out of Delaware County.
Yeah. And it seems like there are a lot of kind of like first term Republicans mm-hmm. here that could possibly be vulnerable.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the Republicans who are first terms, when you look at a Chris Quinn and Alex Charlton, they, in my opinion, after working so hard in 2016, they absolutely rode the Trump wave. So they need to be careful, I think.
With the blue tsunami coming. They need to let it happen.
So as like stressed, as much time as you can help your local candidates, it's super important. There's a lot of seats here that we can flip that are trending blue, that if we just could get turnout. So that's like the big thing that I think, to sum it all up, is to get involved. And whether that's going directly to a campaign, going to your local committee person, or going to the Delaware County Democratic Party, whatever you can do in order to get these people elected, is, I can't stress how important that is.
Absolutely.
2018 is going to mean a lot at the state level and at the federal level.
You know, this is a way that we can really kind of help put the brakes on, you know, Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and all of those friggin' lunatics.
All of these races are super important, but we also in Delaware County desperately need new people to run for
yes.
committee positions.
Yes.
In your local area, if you are registered to vote, you are registered to be on committee. If you don't know your committee person, then maybe that means you should be the next one. They get to decide who to endorse, who to support, how the Democratic Party functions in the county. So if you're upset with how the party functions at the state, we need you even more local, which is in the county. And if you need help, you can always reach out to us. We will try and post things on our Facebook about how to run. But if you don't know how to get in touch with your local party, or if they're not answering you, we will. So
yeah, yes. Absolutely. And being a community person is very easy. You need to get, 10 signatures to get on the ballot?
Yeah, 10 signatures to get your name on the ballot, and then people
you
vote.
You usually in Delaware County run unopposed.
Often.
This might be the first year.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully this will be a year where people aren't just running unopposed for that.
I hope so.
But yes, please, if you can't get a hold of your local party or anything like that, you can shoot us an email. You can get us on Facebook. Mike@DelcoYoungDemocast.com. Gina@DelcoYoungDemocast.com. Pasquale@DelcoYoungDemocast.com. Any one of us would be happy to help you out with that. All right. So Gina's got to take off, unfortunately, but we are going to put in the conversation that Pasquale and I had with Dr. Molly Sheehan, who is running for Congress for the 7th District. So enjoy. Enjoy. Dr. Molly Sheehan received her bachelor's degree in biology at Haverford College and her PhD in biochemistry and biophysics at the University of Pennsylvania. She's currently a postdoctoral fellow in the Penn Bioengineering Department. She's running for the Democratic nomination for U.S. House of Representatives for the 7th District of Pennsylvania, which includes large portions of Delaware County. Dr. Molly Sheehan, thank you so much for joining us on the Delco Young Democast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we are going to start off just with the basics. Where did you grow up? How did you grow up? What was the situation?
Yeah, so I grew up mostly in Delaware, Montgomery counties. I went to Perkiomen Valley Schools in Montgomery County, and I like to joke in this hugely gerrymandered district, I was fortunate to have divorced parents, so I got to live in many places throughout the district. So my dad, most of my childhood, lived in Springfield, Delaware County, and we moved a little bit. We also lived in Norristown and Shillington and Conshohocken for brief periods of time, but always coming back to where he grew up in Springfield, Delaware County. And my parents were both people who worked in the community. My mom ran a small art school, after-school programs that had a hard time surviving. I guess it didn't survive when the economy hit the recession. And now she's a one-on-one aide for autistic children. Awesome. And my dad is an analytical chemist who worked for the Department of Environmental Protection for 35 years, mostly covering Superfund sites in Montgomery County. So I kind of grew up at the dinner table hearing the political turmoil of Pennsylvania and why dad could or couldn't clean up some toxic spill in someone's water, depending on the zip code.
So, yeah, I mean, with your father working for the state, you know, were they, I guess they weren't outrightly sort of politically active?
Yeah. So my dad, because he worked for the state, couldn't engage directly in politics, but we were definitely politically engaged as a family. My parents are, his recovering Catholics gone hippies, our educated hippies. And social justice was always a central part of my childhood. I grew up in a Quaker family going to meeting. And from a young age, we did a lot of community service and work with Quaker organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. And with my dad, we were really involved in environmental justice, and we spent our weekends at the recycling center in Birdsboro, separating people's plastics and learning my polymer chemistry, you know, learning which plastic is which and the properties. And so we've always, as a family, tried to live by, you know, the principles that we're preaching and trying not to undo the work dad does all day with our own poor lifestyles.
Yeah. Was there a specific sort of like a flashpoint moment where you sort of connected directly with the political process, or was it sort of more gradual?
So I was always pretty politically engaged in terms of like the justice movement. Like I was the annoying high schooler that was taping up signs about which products you should boycott because they're made by children in Burma, slave labor. Or even in high school, I was pulled into the principal's office before Arlen Specter came to visit our school for an assembly as a targeted troublemaker and given a list of questions I was not allowed to ask the senator.
Didn't he retire as a Democrat?
Yeah, predominantly I was not allowed to ask about Anita Hill. I had been like singled out as the person who cannot ask about Anita Hill. So I've always been pinpointed as like the political rabble rouser, I guess. Even in college, I did a lot of community outreach and a lot of work with homeless groups, but I had always been more involved in the community side of things. But I mean, as you guys know, everything interplays with politics. There's always political reasons you can or can't succeed. And even throughout college and graduate school, I served on a lot of boards for reviewing graduate studies and making sure it's working for everybody. And a board that purchased group health insurance for all students at the University of Pennsylvania through the ACA rollout. So that was very, you know, politically involved in the sense that, you know, we were completely at the whims of whatever was happening politically. So I had been really involved in my community, and I had gotten really involved as I had a child in the parents' community and doing outreach there and building programs for early childhood education in public schools. But really, the 2016 election and the horrific rhetoric and bigotry and misogyny that came out of it, and not just that Trump was saying it, because there's always one jerk, but the national enabling and the national excusing of it was really activating to say, it's no longer appropriate for me to just live a comfortable life and in some of my spare time, you know, do community activism, it's really necessary for me to redefine where I can have the biggest social impact. And I didn't think doing scientific research was that place anymore, that it was really necessary for me to step up into the political realm and kind of reclaim our democracy for normal people who actually work in the economies of our areas.
Yeah, since you're a first-time candidate, you're kind of new to running for office, you know, is there any sort of political mentors or teachers that have been helping you out?
Yeah, so my campaign manager was a volunteer for a long time for my campaign, and he's been incredibly helpful. His name's Jamie Malley, and he was a county legislator in New York probably about 20 years ago, and then worked for Joe Hoffel's campaign with Field here, and then organized for Bernie, and then he kind of chose me. He sort of just mass volunteered for my campaign, and then I hired him eventually. But he's been really helpful in, you know, as someone who's been around politics longer than I have, or been around everything longer than I have. Yeah, mentoring me in the political realm. And I also, when I first got into this, I got a lot of great advice from Val Arcouche, who's the commissioner of Montgomery County, who in this small world actually trained my husband also, because they're both anesthesiologists.
Oh, okay.
She was actually his attending when he was a resident too. So she was very helpful in just talking to me about, you know, lessons she learned from her own campaign and how she, you know, if she were to do it again, would run a campaign with a lot of integrity. And she's just a very kind, thoughtful person to talk to in politics. Yeah.
We already touched on why now, but why this office in particular? Why your first time running? Did you want to run for the U.S. House?
Yeah, so I thought about that quite a bit when I decided I thought my voice was needed in electoral politics itself. That, but my number one issue and the place that I feel I have the largest voice is to push for healthcare reform and push us towards single payer healthcare. That's really where most of my work experience has been. And one of the reasons I decided to run for this for U.S. Congress is that we've really left out of the conversation a lot of the structural problems that lead to our healthcare being too expensive. And it isn't just the way we pay for things. And I mean, the reality of whoever wins this seat is, chances are, even if we get the House back, we have to get things through a Republican Senate and a Republican, and at least a Republican White House. And so being able to, you know, reforming a sixth of our economy is going to take a really long time. And I have a lot of ideas about bipartisan reforms we can push through that'll start improving our quality of care, start reducing healthcare costs right away before we have the power to push through a sort of omnibus single payer bill. Things like doing drug research in a way that actually produces drugs that work for women as well as they do for men. Because right now we spend a huge amount of money on drugs that don't even work for people, and that we get huge amounts of side effects that predominantly affect women. And 11% of our healthcare costs are from hospital admissions as a result of side effects of drugs and treatments. Wow. And that predominantly affects women. And so these are ways we can really rein in healthcare costs while improving the quality of care, and things that don't cost a ton of money, even up front. They're, you know, educational initiatives. Most scientists want to know when they should use a female model versus a male model. And you know, every single one of our cells of our body is a female or a male cell. And so we really need to be looking at sex differences beyond reproductive healthcare in our research, which is what historically we've been separating it on.
So running the campaign, this is your first time, right?
Yeah.
So has there been anything that has surprised you, aside obviously from the wild shape of the district? Has there been anything that you like really weren't prepared for that you've encountered over the course of this campaign?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say that everything's a matter of degrees. That there's nothing that was like completely shocking, but I've been surprised by the depth of control our campaign industrial complex has over our electoral process and how ingrained a lot of our party system is, especially as, you know, you start moving out of the local level, like the state level and the national level, how a lot of these, and not just the party, but the PACs that go along with it, and how this whole system is really focused singularly on money and where money's going, and there's this huge amount of pressure to be what I call a pile of fluff, where you don't really have stances on anything and everything's about being, quote, palatable to donors, because then you can raise money to pay consultants to buy ads, but you're not really pushing an agenda. You're just trying, it's all about name recognition and it's all about manipulative advertising. And I think I had underestimated the momentum of that system and how hard it is, or just how much effort it takes to advocate against it for a campaign that really is based in authentic communication and based in authentic messaging, things I really believe in and true values.
As a woman and a millennial woman, have you seen that affecting you in your run for office, especially in a especially this race, male dominated bid for this congressional seat?
Yeah. You know, I think any other year it definitely would have, but particularly in the wake of the Me Too movement, I find being a woman is helpful in more rooms than it hurts me. I mean, certainly I face, you know, sexism frequently, but I mean, I'm in a male dominated field now, so it's not, I wouldn't say it's particularly new. And, yeah, so I think being a woman is helpful in that women really dominate primary voters, and that women are also looking for younger faces, particularly given the age of who we saw running for president in 2016. I think people are kind of aware that our party has aged, and a lot of people are looking for younger faces who can grow in the party and can like build a bench, and not just build a bench by running for school board. And I mean, I think being young also, I don't think my PhD helps me in terms of like the research I did with voters, but I mean, not that it hurts, but it's not a big plus, but I think it shows people that I'm not a flippant young person, that I don't make decisions lightly, and that I do follow through on things, and I can finish a project that takes 5 or 6 years and come out the other side successful. And so people maybe don't have some of the reservations they would have about me being young had I not had those 3 letters after my name.
So now I'm very excited to get back to what you touched on earlier about healthcare. So you've spoken a lot about getting healthcare costs under control as the first step to fixing our system in America. And what are some of your proposals to accomplish that?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. Yeah, so the one thing is, you know, like I said, actually teaching people when they shouldn't use a female model and when they need to, test things in female models. Because who knows, maybe there might be drugs that got shelved that work really well in women. Also, it might be a way of also some companies making more money. This isn't necessarily something that even costs money. Some other things we need to do is talk about how things are made. That why is it your tax dollars pay for NIH, the National Institute of Health Research, and academia that's supposed to be for the public good, and then that develops a drug that then you can't afford. And there's a breakdown there in our patent process, and a breakdown there where researchers often aren't able to start small biotech companies to develop their own drugs. They're almost a lot of times feel forced to sell it to large pharmaceutical companies. And so talking about patent reform and talking about how we actually develop drugs and how do we make sure that goes for the public good, and how do we make sure money from investments come back to our funding bodies so we can continue to fund research. Like these kinds of things will lower healthcare costs. There's also a lot of things we can do in terms of quality control with hospitals and efficiency of the system. So one of the big things I talk about is homogenizing electronic medical records, which means if you go to a doctor and then you go to another one, your record transfers. Mm-hmm. Or if you end up in an ER somewhere else, that they know they have your medical record. They don't give you a drug that your doctor knew you were allergic to, something that could have been a couple hours in the ER. Does it turn into a month? You know, it's both financially irresponsible and it's inhumane. Or even within hospitals, making sure people are using the correct diagnostics and not wasting money on things that don't work. Things that can be pretty inexpensive fixes, that these are software fixes. But it takes a really long time to implement. We have a really sprawling healthcare system. But those kinds of things, because we're not talking about how we pay for healthcare, are much more likely to get bipartisan support on. There's not this sort of ideological stalemate surrounding who pays for what when. Mm-hmm.
You said you previously sat on a board that negotiated the health insurance plans for UPenn students. What do you think are some of the unique healthcare needs that college and college age individuals have that are kind of being overlooked in the larger conversation about healthcare?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So one of the things that this is one of the reasons I avoid using the term Medicare for all, and something that is, it's not unique to college students, but it was definitely at the forefront of our conversations, is reproductive health, particularly reproductive health for reproductive age women. And Medicare has almost by definition doesn't affect that population. And we see, you know, the horrific conversations in Congress about, you know, trying to, should we be paying for birth control for women? I mean, these ridiculous conversations. Is pregnancy a pre-existing condition to healthcare? And I don't want, as we start expanding healthcare to younger populations, that, I mean, that's a critical, it's a foundational part of the policy. And we need to make sure that there's firewalls between those types of misogynists in Congress and whoever is developing what is and is not covered on the plan and to what extent. We need to make sure that women have access to a full spectrum of reproductive health care. And it's actually the reason I would not have supported Conyers' bill, but I would co-sponsor Bernie's bill for single-payer health care, is he actually included a repeal of the Hyde Amendment, which says that federal funds can't go to abortion services at all. And if we ever pass single-payer health care without that repeal, we're inherently cutting off poor women to the full spectrum of legal reproductive health care. I mean, they have constitutionally guaranteed rights that they're essentially being denied based on finances. And the other thing that we probably dealt with the most in our population that I would say it's also not unique. I don't think college students actually have that unique of needs. It's just that maybe we had a more progressive board that was willing to discuss them openly, is mental health care. And we absolutely need comprehensive mental health care. And some of the people actually I've spoken to who are most excited about single payer health care with comprehensive health care is veterans. That the idea that they have to wait a long time to go see a therapist and they only have one choice at a VA is really limiting. Having a therapist is such a personal decision who it's going to be, that they really deserve access to all therapists of their choice. And I mean, that's something we should be covering now also in, as a step to single payer, is all veterans should have access to whatever mental health care provider that they want.
Okay, so this question might be maybe like a two, maybe even three part question. When it comes to talking about climate change, you hear a lot of people addressing the 2 degree rise in temperature. And is that the number we should be worried about, would be my first question, or is there too much emphasis on that? And then my next question is, as potentially Congresswoman Sheehan in the future, my question would be, in a state, even though it's not Delaware County, in a state like Pennsylvania, where Trump promised, you know, coal's coming back when it clearly isn't, what would you have any plans to help create a greener economy in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, those are great questions. So in terms of the 2 degrees and climate change, I mean, 2 degrees is definitely alarming, and there's a lot of modeling that went into that number. But the reality is we don't actually know what the number is that's going to create, you know, unstoppable climate change, that there's all of these tipping points that could be reached where things like all the methane is released in the Arctic tundra, or the Amazon becomes incredibly just deforested. And we don't necessarily, a lot of these things are, you know, you reach a critical point and then you can't come back, and then they have a snowballing effect on the climate where we start seeing more warmth and to our climate. But I mean, there's this great book on this called The Weathermakers that goes through global geology over the history and where these tipping points are, and that the reality is we don't know and we're going to hit them. So we should be worried about it. And on the campaign trail, I mean, a lot of people don't care. I mean, it's frigid outside, right? So people say, I don't care if my house is 2 degrees warmer, but here in the South, we have a really strong military community. And I think the biggest argument for this is even if you don't care, there's other areas of the world that makes a huge difference to their crops. It makes a huge difference to their food security. And we've already seen global instability in places like Darfur, where wars have been started because there's a lack of food and a lack of resources. And as climate change gets out of hand, we're going to see an increase of that. And we're all beneficiaries of a stable world. And I don't want people's children, people's husbands, people's fathers and mothers being sent overseas to wars that were preventable had we really gotten our conservation under control now. To me, that's, you know, that's a more immediate danger even than maybe America. Although we do see intensifying weather effects here also, but people should also be really worried about what's happening all over the world. And then this was the second part of your question.
The second part was one of Trump's main selling points in Western and Central PA was bringing back coal. And since that's not the future, do you have any plans for a green economy being implemented in PA?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great, we should be having a bit more green economy. I think most people would rather be installing solar panels than digging in a coal mine. And, we should be moving to a green economy and we should be having more green jobs, things like wind jobs and solar jobs and also jobs just improving the efficiency of our infrastructure. We have a horrible infrastructure problem across our country and there's a lot of things we can do just by improving the technology we have now, just improving the modernity of what we have. That'll make things way more efficient, or having larger rail lines so people aren't just sitting in traffic all the time. Especially for areas like coal country, or I mean, even areas right here where a lot of industries have disappeared with a moving economy. I mean, this is really, it's all related, right? We have a shifting economy and we need to be doing things that allow people to adapt to that, that people who have had a career doing something like working in a coal mine or working in manufacturing where they, I mean, I feel for them. They have this really great skill that's not needed right now. That's really tragic. But the truth is those skills probably apply to other jobs that are necessary. And in particular, in a place like here where we have all of this innovation, but we don't see the tech sector that should be blossoming out of it. Removing the barriers to entrepreneurship for innovators in our area to start companies here and increasing partnerships between academia and industry and community colleges and high schools to make sure that people are really getting educated for the jobs of today. And there isn't some sort of stigma around technical education. And someone who wants a small engineering company can hire people out of high school that know how to code. They know how to work with their hands. They know how to run things. Or people who maybe their job went away can pivot in their career and learn how to use this new piece of equipment, you know, for some tech startup. That we should really be fostering those kinds of shifts in our economy and building a tech and biotech sector right here, because we have the perfect place for it, especially in places like Delaware County.
Okay, so you've mentioned Senator Bernie Sanders a couple of times. One of his big platform issues in 2016 was justice reform. Can you talk about your views on reforming the justice system real quickly?
Sure. I absolutely think we need criminal justice reform, that our current system is punitive in nature, which is unhelpful. I mean, I understand people have this basal need for vengeance sometimes, but as a society, I mean, I think this is exactly where the government should step in and say, that's not helpful. This isn't really what we should be doing. And we see the systemic racism of the system also, where white people tend to be given forgiveness and leniency and expungements, where Black people, especially Black men, are not. And particularly for drug offenses, that I am for the legalization of marijuana, both for recreational and medicinal purposes. I'm also for the decriminalization of addiction, that if something being illegal should never stand between somebody getting help and going back to rehab. And addiction shouldn't be treated as something that should send someone to jail. And I also think we need to really talk about a system that's focused on rehabilitation, even though sometimes maybe that makes us uncomfortable, depending on the offense, that the reality is that's what's best for society. And the more punitive we are, the higher rates of recidivism we see, that those people just end up going back over and over again to the system. And so, especially for nonviolent offenders, we really need path to expungement. It shouldn't be this black mark on someone's life forever. And I also think we should nationally be giving felons, after they're done serving their time, back the right to vote, that no one should ever lose their ability to partake in democracy once they've served their time. I think we really do need to be focused on bringing people back into society, and it'll save us time. And I mean, as you guys know, in Delaware County, you also have the only private prison. I'm also opposed to all private prisons, that no one should make money off of the incarceration of another human being.
The Justice Department just this past week changed their policy of non-interference with the states who have legalized marijuana. In the same week, Pennsylvania gave the final okay for the state's first medical marijuana dispensary. What do you think that the U.S. Congress can actually do to kind of reconcile this disagreement and protect patients in Pennsylvania and the other states that have legalized medical marijuana specifically?
Well, I mean, Congress passed the federal law to legalize marijuana. And particularly when we're talking about medical marijuana, I mean, this is really a fundamental problem we have with, it's not just marijuana, it's also, we see it in reproductive health care a lot, where there's this movement, especially on the far right wing and the Tea Partiers, to really criminalize medicine, that there's no justification for a physician not being able to prescribe THC when they can prescribe opioids. Like, that's ridiculous. And the idea that we're, you know, basically handcuffing physicians from giving patients the full spectrum of available medicine is with no scientific backing of it. And I mean, a lot of THC medicines don't even make you high. I mean, they're able to formulate them in that way. So when we're talking about medicinal marijuana, I mean, there's really no way to justify the medical marijuana being illegal. And especially, I mean, we're in this face of this opioid crisis. And I mean, medical marijuana is not going to solve the opioid crisis, but it certainly can help alleviate some of it. But some people that do take opioids could take marijuana derivatives instead. And right now, that's not an option in a lot of places. And the idea that someone like Jeff Sessions is trying to push regressive policies to undo the progress we've been making is really disheartening. I'm married to a pain physician, and when he was on pain clinic in residency, I mean, he has a tough job already, but the saddest he ever was coming home from pain clinic, because people come in and they're in pain and he sees all the red flags of this person is likely to become an addict, but they have real pain and it's not really, he had nothing else to give them for their real pain except opioids, especially when they're on something like Medicaid. There's nothing else he can do to treat this person. He's allotted 10 or 15 minutes to treat this person. He can't give him acupuncture or chiropractic. They can't afford it somewhere else. And he knows he's sending addicts out the door, but the system has really tied his hands. And Jeff Sessions is just part of that horrific system that is creating addicts and limiting options of physicians that want to do best by their patients. And Congress absolutely should and can step in and legalize marijuana, that there's no reason not to.
Yeah, as kind of like a quick follow-up, you know, based on what you've said there, but as the resident, the expert in the room right now on medical research, you do believe that there is compelling evidence for medical uses of marijuana?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some populations where it's almost a miracle drug, like cancer patients who have no appetite and are feeling horrible from their chemo, and it doesn't interfere with their chemo. And I mean, especially somebody who they're pumping their body through full of toxic chemicals, and we're saying that they can't take this little pill that'll make them feel better, smoke a joint, is ridiculous. Because what they need is food. We're basically preventing them from eating food, taking a drug that would allow them to eat food. I mean, and the truth is, there's a huge amount of evidence for THC being a treatment for lots of things. And the arguments against it, that there are some side effects of it, I think is kind of ridiculous, because there's side effects to every single drug. Yeah. And that should be something that you discuss in the clinic with your physician and make the decision with your physician in private, whether that's a risk you want to take for a drug, and whether the side effect is something you're willing to assume in order for the to have the benefits of the drug. And that's a conversation with every single prescription. And marijuana is no different. And in a lot of cases for pain is a much easier conversation.
Makes perfect sense to me. So I have to be the bad guy to ask the hard question on this one. Some of your opponents have kind of accused you of basically, you know, being a carpetbagger because they're twice as old as us, and that's the word they use. You know, basically that you're moving into the district in order to run. You know, I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
So I have a 3-year-old, and I'm moving home to raise her where, you know, where my home is and where my family lives, and I'm going to be just as invested as anybody else. I'm going to be paying property tax. I'm going to be paying property taxes. I'm going to be sending my child to public schools. And it's true, I've been in Philadelphia for my education, and I'm finishing up my fellowship in bioengineering right now at Penn. But I mean, I'm moving home. This is where I'm from. It's where I've spent most of my life. It's where I went to college at Haverford. I lived in Springfield and Drexel Hill for a few years after. And yeah, I'm not choosing a random district because it's opportunistic. It's where my family is, and it's where, you know, my family is invested.
Running a political campaign is one of the hardest things you can do. On top of that, you have an extraordinarily demanding job, and you're a mother to a young child. What are some of like your self-care techniques? What do you do to just kind of unwind?
Yeah, I used to take care of myself. That's definitely true. I used to exercise. I used to run a lot. I ran in high school and college, and I run occasionally now. And I still try to bake. My daughter's always asking me to bake things. That's my hidden talent. If we meet up in person again, I'll bring you guys baked goods.
Oh, I would. they will be gone in a minute.
I mean, the reality is the thing that I do most for self-care is just time with my phone off with my daughter. That family time is my reset time, and I'm fortunate to have a healthy, happy, wonderful family. And so that's really the base of my self-care now.
Excellent. All right. Yeah. So just to wrap things up, I have a little challenge for you. The title of your doctoral thesis is Engineering Oxygen Reactivity in Heme Protein Maquettes. Can you explain to me, a complete dummo, what that actually means in like 30 seconds? And I am going to be timing you.
All right. I'm going to take a deep breath. All right. So proteins are molecules that do things throughout your body. They do everything, really. And there's a whole natural array of proteins, but they have evolved over time to do specific things. And if we just tweak them, a lot of times we have other functions or they're not very efficient because they were meant to do something else. So I want to build functions into proteins that don't exist right now to we can then put back into the body. And so in my thesis research, I was using proteins that are electronically active. They move electrons kind of like electricity. And then those electrons can do chemistry, make other molecules off of them or carry oxygen like blood. And I was studying those and I created what we call a molecular laboratory to study how those things work. And we can make them have functions that proteins have never had before because it's a completely bottom-up system that no one's ever made before from scratch.
Awesome. That was just a little more than 30 seconds, but we'll count it because that was, I could figure out what you were saying, which was cool.
Explain anything in 30 seconds.
Dr. Molly Sheehan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was a really good conversation.
I was
into that.
blown away by, yes. I love the environmental stuff.
Yes.
I love the response. Yes.
As a group, the Delaware County Young Democrats are not going to be making endorsements in primaries, but hopefully we can have all of the candidates on here and you can kind of make an informed decision as to who you like yourself.
Yes, we're doing all the easy work for you, so we better see you voting.
Like, for real.
don't make me complain on Facebook again, because it will happen.
You've been doing good, man. You've been behaving yourself.
I've been slowing it down. There's some groups that you go into and I'm lighting it up. So just if you see me on Facebook, you know, if you see me in the streets, say hey.
So We want to do our now regular feature that none of us really seem to like all that much.
It's becoming worse every week.
What did millennials kill this time? This week, apparently millennials have killed fabric softener. According to an article in the Wall Street Journal, Procter & Gamble's sales have dropped precipitously. The biggest reason for this is that they say that younger consumers are just not buying fabric softeners, dryer sheets, or the liquid stuff. Their theory is that it's because we grew up not doing chores. So therefore, we're lazy and don't care about fabric softener.
No, actually, do you wash your clothes? I don't. I have not washed a single piece of clothing in 25 years of being alive.
I just buy new clothes and burn the old ones.
Yeah, while I'm eating avocado toast.
Yes, with all that money that I'm swimming in.
I spread it with a golden fork. And I eat it off a golden plate. And I throw my clothes out every day.
Exactly.
Every day I drive to, whatever, Gucci, Prada, get a new outfit. And then when I'm done, I throw it out. It's just so inconvenient to have a dishwasher.
God.
Have a washer, not a dishwasher. Shit.
That's fine.
Millennials killed that anyway, too. I'm sure we can reuse.
I guarantee. We'll cut it out and save it for later. But, yeah, that was apparently the... it's not the fact that the technology of washers and dryers has improved over the past, 80 years. It's not the fact that we don't want to have, flammable chemicals all over our bodies. It's not the fact that we're now wearing like real fibers instead of like polyester and better living through chemistry shit.
And but in the study it says it right there. Procter and Gamble reported their own sales. That's like before. It's because it's toxic. Like people use Method now. People use other laundry detergents. Yeah. I think the only reason I've ever used a softener was so that my clothes aren't staticky and don't zap the shit out of me when I open the thing. But
yeah, and I don't care about that. So
yeah, whatever.
I like when my hair does that weird standing
up thing. Hold on to something metal while you're reaching into the dryer to grab it out.
Chase the cat around.
Yeah, there you go. I at first I really started liking doing these things, and now every time I don't look at it anymore. When we had this sheet and it was like, this is what we're talking about. I'm like, nope. I'm not clicking the link. I'm not reading it. I'm not surprised we killed fabric softeners. I can't wait to find out.
Man, it keeps getting dumber and dumber. In the inimitable style of our friends over at Vice, who are problematic in their own way. But they do have a way of putting things. When they rounded up everything that millennials killed in 2017, the final entry was fabric softener. Their only statement was, what the fuck even is this?
I'm glad that was the final one. It's like a huge list, and then it's like a fabric softener. I want to know what the first...
There was all kinds of stuff on that list. I don't have it up in front of me right this second, but there was drugs and drinking were on that. Police were on that. All kinds of ridiculous things.
You know what? I'm going to light this up. I can't. Millennials did not kill civil rights. I'm going to start there. Okay. Millennials didn't start these homophobic movements and misogynistic movements. But you're right. Fabric sheets. You're right. Fabric softeners. We're pieces of shit.
That's really the biggest problem that we have facing us in 2018 America.
You know, maybe fabric softeners could suck the oil out of the ocean. We would use them. How about Procter & Gamble works on that? And then I will gladly spend my money, very little of it that I make, to help restore the ocean. That's going to be my big thing. Anytime someone says millennials ruin, I'm just going to say the ocean, the whole ocean, all the water on the planet, the entire water system from when it's in the ground into the air and falls back down. You fucked it.
And you won't be wrong when you say that.
No. And I'm happy with that. I'm happy that I get that's going to be my defense.
Oh, man. All right. Let's coast to a gentle ending here. We're going to talk about... as we always do, because self-care is important. What is something that you actually enjoyed that has nothing to do with politics over the past couple weeks? I've got one if you don't.
Yeah, you can go first.
The friggin' X-Files came back.
Oh!
It is my favorite TV show of all time. That should tell you a lot about me. I was fully prepared to hate this after the unqualified disaster that was season number 10 that they aired a little while ago. But the first episode has aired so far, and I am in 100%.
I was just about to give away spoilers when you said that. But you reminded me my self-care, which actually isn't self-care because it's so stressful. I binge-watched season 4 of Black Mirror when they put it on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, I'm always like, Black Mirror is so close to happening. We're going to be like living in each other's brains. And then the printer at work jams and I'm like, never mind. We're far
we're
off.
We're safe.
Me, my one coworker, we're always like, no, it's White Window is what it is now. It's not Black Mirror. It's White Window.
So yeah, that's going to do it for us today on the Delco Young Demicast. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks again to Molly Sheehan for joining us. I want to give a special shout out to the band Tin Mouth for letting us use their song Generation to Generation as our theme song. Please check us out on Facebook at Delco Young Dems. You can also follow the show on Twitter now at DY Democast. You can observe all of my tomfoolery and, you know...
Buffoolery, yes. And goonery.
Yes. All of our japery. I hope that's not one of those phrases that people use that's accidentally racist.
You know what? I'm never surprised anymore.
Yeah, but please let us know you're out there. If you're enjoying the show, you can rate us on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcatcher you like. You can make sure that you're subscribed to us. We're on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, all your favorite places. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks.